hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the honorable justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the honorable court.
Good morning. The court's ready to hear argument in Stewart v. State. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Figueroa.
Good morning, Justice Hollins, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. The case before us today, I'd like to start out. First off, we're not arguing that the State v. Rogers, the Rogers v. State cited by the state and relied on by Judge Silverman in his underlying is totally off guard. What we're arguing is it didn't go far enough. I understand what 4177 says about similar statutes. The issue that I'm raising here is the issue of enhanced penalties and whether 4177, without taking into consideration this court's ruling in Fletcher and Morales, even though they deal with habitual offender statutes, was in fact correct. That was the issue raised initially and ruled in favor of the Mr. Stewart. Of course, it was then taken up by the state, and the Superior Court found that Rogers was controlling. Rogers does not go far enough. Rogers simply says, we've got a similar statute, we can therefore sentence you accordingly.
Help me understand the distinction between the similarity of the statutes and the evidence that's necessary to convict. Let's suppose the two statutes were written identically, word for word, and then hypothetically, they're word for word, and then aside, we have how do you prove the elements of the offense. For purposes of my hypothetical, let's assume the statutes are written identically, word for word, and there's no blood alcohol test. So you have a person convicted of driving under the influence of alcohol, and we don't know what the evidence was. What would your argument be?
The argument would be that the state would be required to prove to support the enhanced penalty would have to produce documentation from the charging state, Florida, North Carolina, whatever, showing what Mr. Stewart was charged with, what he pled to, and what the elements of those plea was. That is exactly what Morales says, and that's what Fletcher says. It's not a stretch. And I guess that's part of my argument here. This was not a big deal for the state to write a letter to Florida and get this information. They felt they didn't have to do it.
So what did they present in this case, in your view?
The only thing they presented, Your Honor, was a Division of Motor Vehicle documentation that in fact showed that Mr. Stewart was found guilty of driving under the influence in the state of Florida.
Now, Delaware one or Florida one?
Florida was the first one, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Florida is a .08 state. Okay? And there was no documentation as to the basis for that plea.
Well, you see, that's where I'm coming back to my distinction between the statute and the evidence, because as the state points out in its brief, the old Delaware statute talked about presumptions below 0.05, above 0.05, or above 0.10. But we have had a lot of people who have been convicted of violating the statute when there's no test, simply based on testimony from people that saw them drink or saw their conduct or things like that.
If, in fact, Your Honor, the state had produced documentation that Mr. Stewart was arrested in Florida, he was convicted without a test, we wouldn't be standing here. But they didn't do that. The point is this. Had Mr. Stewart been driving down a street in the city of Wilmington and was at a stop by a sobriety checkpoint, was doing nothing else wrong, got out of his vehicle and tested 0.08, he would not have been charged with a DUI.
Now, how do you know that?
He did nothing wrong.
Oh, you mean, so there's no erratic driving?
There's no erratic, nothing. It's just a sobriety checkpoint. 0.08. Be careful, and he's on his way.
Well, doesn't that, are you saying that the presumption of intoxication fixed at 1.0 under the current statute is a requirement?
No.
Or is it anything under 1.0 means no conviction?
Under 0.1, with absent any other evidence of erratic driving, you would walk. Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And why is that?
Because of the way the statute, you have to prove driving under the influence. Weaving in and out of cars, speeding, crossing the center line, running somebody off the road. Yes. But without any of that, you're just simply driving in a straight line. You're not violating any law. There's no probable cause to pull you over. The only way you're pulled over is because there's a legal sobriety check where you blow the point away.
Suppose there was probable cause for some unrelated reason.
Yes, you could be found guilty of a DUI under 0.10 under Delaware's law.
Right. So it isn't necessary that there be, in the absence of a 1.0 test, it isn't absolutely necessary that there be erratic driving if there's some other basis to stop the car.
That's correct, Your Honor.
One other question. Is it your position, let me back up for a moment, as I understand it, the current formulation of the test that would be required to visit an enhanced penalty or a habitual penalty, habitual criminal penalty, is that the statute of the foreign state under which there was a conviction must be similar.
That is correct.
Is it your argument that similar has to be construed to mean identical?
No, but...
But isn't that what you're saying?
No, not necessarily. What I'm saying is that there is, Florida is similar, but there is a significant difference. That significant difference being the difference between 0.08 and 0.1. 0.1 is an absolute in Delaware. You're stopped, you got a 0.1, you're guilty. In Florida, you're stopped 0.08, absent anything else, you're guilty. My point is, if you're stopped 0.08, did nothing else in the state of Florida, under those same circumstances in the state of Delaware, you would not have committed the crime of driving under the influence.
Is that right? Or is it that you would not have been, there would have been no probable cause to stop you? I mean, don't confuse probable cause with...
Well, and this is from experience.
At the risk of introducing something concrete, let me read the statute. What the statute says is that if you're above 0.05, there isn't a presumption that you were under the influence, but such fact may be considered with other competent evidence in determining whether the person was under the influence.
Correct.
So when you say the person's going to walk, that's not necessarily true. I mean, it's up to the discretion of the policeman to decide what they're going to do, but there wouldn't be a conclusive presumption. Now, the question that I'd like you to answer directly is, what if your view prevails, what would you have presented in future cases when someone wants to demonstrate that there's a prior conviction from Florida or any other state? What testimony or what piece of paper do you think would be appropriate?
A certified copy of the conviction and or plea, the indictment, and a copy of the police report.
Now, why is that relevant when you're trying to make a judicial determination about the similarity of the statutes?
It's important because we're dealing with whether an individual is going to be serving mandatory jail time. That's my argument, that you have to go beyond the similarity and take this extra step into consideration, because it's more than an administrative take away your license for 6 months or a year. The statute specifically says that a subsequent DUI is a mandatory 60 days in jail. So you're taking away somebody's freedom, not just the privilege, but they're actually taking away their freedom. So it's important, and I argue mandated, that you have to be positive, be sure that the crime that you're using as that underlying crime, I'm using the word crime because there's a jail sentence involved, is such that it would have been a crime in Delaware so that the enhancement can come into place. And that's what Fletcher says.
What is your concern in this case? That they didn't prove he was convicted before, or that they didn't prove the conduct for which he was convicted before would have gotten him convicted in Delaware?
It's the second argument, Your Honor.
So there's no doubt he was convicted of driving under the influence in Florida, and
there
the state
is.
Presented that evidence.
My client conceded that.
Okay. So this is analogous to cases that I've read from the Third Circuit, where for federal purposes, when you want to enhance someone's status, to sentence them as a habitual offender, and they looked at Pennsylvania law to decide whether some type of burglary was a residence as opposed to a commercial property, if there's just a generic term, because the nature of the offense is important for some purposes in the federal enhancement. And that's your argument here.
Right. I mean, you're comparing, if it was an exact 0.1, 0.1, or as we have now, 0.08, and he pled guilty, it would make no difference. But it does make a difference here, just for that argument I had made earlier. If he stopped at a sobriety check, has done absolutely nothing wrong, and he's a 0.08, it's not impossible he could be charged in Delaware, but it's highly unlikely.
Well, but I don't understand why this evidence with his blood alcohol reading, it is relevant if he pled guilty to a similar statute. Help me understand that. That's why I went back to my question about, let's suppose there was no test.
The relevance is simply this, and if I can compare it to, let's for example say that you want to enhance my penalty because I pled guilty to theft in the state of Pennsylvania. Now, theft in the state of Pennsylvania may read up to including $2,500. Now, that could be considered a felony in the state of Delaware depending on the amount of the theft. If the state wanted to use that theft conviction, they could not just come in and say, well, Mr. Stewart pled guilty to theft, we're going to enhance his penalty. They would have to show that that theft would have been a felony in the state of Delaware.
So let's take this case.
Yes.
Follow up on Justice Holland's question. The defendant in Delaware, former defendant in Florida, pleads guilty to an indictment where he's charged with having 0.08.
Correct.
Or a little over 0.08 blood alcohol. And his argument in Delaware would be, yes, I concede that that alone would be enough to convict me.
Correct.
But it's not enough to convict me in Delaware because there's nothing else that's before the court other than that blood alcohol reading.
That's correct. That's our argument.
All right. And there would have to be more than a plea. There would either have to be a 0.10 or higher reading
or
a less than a 0.10, but proof of erratic driving or at least an indictment that alleged that?
Correct. Or in the alternative, if the state had produced evidence that there was no intoxilizer and my client pled guilty to DUI, that would be sufficient.
Why would that be?
Because the statutes are similar and they say that you can be convicted of a DUI, okay, based on erratic driving, blood alcohol content over a certain amount. But they both have the additional caveat that says you are definitely guilty if you're at 0.1 in Delaware or 0.08 in Florida. And that's where that's our argument is that's the separating point. You've got to let the court know what was the basis for his Florida conviction. Because if it was simply the .08 and nothing else, he would arguably would not have been charged and would not have been convicted in the state of Delaware and would not be facing jail time.
The record in this case showed that your client was convicted of simply the statute or for the statute, or did it go into detail as to which subsection?
There was absolutely no evidence presented by the state of Delaware to indicate which subsection it was.
Well, what was on the driving record?
The driving record just said DUI conviction.
And do you want to save the other 3.5 minutes?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Brown.
Justice Holland, Justice Jacobson, Justice Ridley. My name is Tom Brown. I represent the state in this matter. It seems to be some of the discussions getting a little off track in the sense that 4177B is very clear that the defendant is on notice that if he's convicted of a DUI under a statute, under the Delaware statute or a similar statute, that counts as a qualifying offense for the enhanced penalty. To that end, and that's why we argue that Morales and Fletcher really don't apply, because Morales and Fletcher are cases of statutory interpretation under Title 11, under the habitual offender status statute, which is worded differently, comes with different interests and sort of a suggestion of a different quantum of proof.
Yeah. Mr. Pigliano says there's enough of the similarity when you're going to go to jail for a mandatory time that whether it's 60 days or life, you're interested in not going to jail.
Certainly not. No suggestion of minimizing the impact on the particular defendant. The point I was emphasizing was the wording of the statute is what applies. In a sense, Justice Silverman takes a moment to point out sort of a freestyle, if you will, in his opinion, that the statute is fair because it provides notice to the defendant. Now here, the defendant, there's no dispute that the defendant was convicted under the Florida statute. There's no conflict that he was convicted of a DUI in Delaware. There's no conflict that the DUI in Florida preceded the Delaware conviction. And therefore, under the statute, as it's plainly worded, the enhanced penalty was warranted.
Ms. Brown, is it your position that all that's needed is the fact of the prior conviction in Florida?
Yes.
You're arguing that no additional evidence is needed. That is, no evidence that that conviction would also have justified a conviction under the Delaware statute.
That is correct. I mean, I guess
is it also your position that there is or there is not such evidence in the record here?
There is evidence. I guess that's the clarification of your question.
Let's suppose we disagreed with your statutory interpretation of and agreed with Mr. Figlio that there has to be evidence that would have, taken together with the conviction, would have amounted to or supported a conviction of Delaware.
Right.
Is such evidence in the record?
The evidence in the record in this case is the defendant's a certified copy of Stewart's driving record produced by the Delaware Division of Motor Vehicles, under his Delaware driver's record. So that is the only effort, and that is sort of, as I understand it from my trial folks, that is sort of the standard operating procedure, is to get a certified copy of the Delaware driving record, and that's what's used.
So that would not necessarily get you over the hurdle, correct?
No, but in a sense it would, because you've been convicted. Well,
we're talking about his driver's record in Florida, aren't we?
Well, Delaware's a compact state, so the two of them exchange records. So Florida communicates their records to Delaware. Delaware communicates their record to Florida, and that's why the fact of the Florida conviction is on his Delaware driver's record.
What, if anything, would the information communicated from Florida tell us or tell the trial court about the circumstances of or the conduct that led to the conviction in Florida?
As I understand it, would not address the circumstances underlying the conviction. And again, that would return to the plain wording of the statute, which says a conviction under this or a similar statute suffices to put a defendant at risk of the enhanced penalty. Now,
well, let me ask you a question in that regard. In Delaware, says under the influence of alcohol, any drug, a combination of alcohol and a drug. In the Delaware statute seems pretty broad. You could be guilty if you took over-the-counter antihistamines or something. For the purpose of my question, let's assume Florida said, in addition to alcohol and drug, they had a third substance, we'll call it X, that Delaware doesn't have. And the argument being made is, well, you know, I was guilty in Florida because I consumed X, and that's a problem in Florida, but it's not a problem in Delaware. Therefore, you shouldn't be able to enhance my Delaware sentence. Would that be something? Because if you look at the piece of paper in my hypothetical, all you would see is you were convicted of driving under the influence in Florida, and the defendant wants to say, but that was based on consumption of X, and X wouldn't have gotten me convicted in Delaware.
Yeah, and under that hypothetical, I think the way to deal with that and in a fairness sense would be to argue whether the statutes are similar or not, because it's not, the statute doesn't guide you to say whether this would be a Delaware conviction. That's much more akin to where 4214 guides you.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get Mr. Figueroa, and I'd like you to help the court understand this difference between the statutes and the evidence, because if you look at the statutes, and the statutes are worded identically, or the results of under the influence, and you plead guilty to being under the influence, then generically you would think that state doesn't want you to drive under the influence of a list, and Delaware doesn't want you to drive under the influence of a list. You've done it twice in two different states. Your sentence is enhanced. Mr. Figueroa wants us to take into consideration the underlying proof that led to either the arrest or the conviction. And my question to you is that relevant? And your answer seems to be only if you can find it in the statute.
That is my answer, yes. And I think under the hypothetical you were outlining about Florida, the way that would be dealt with in a fairness sense is you would begin to contrast material differences in the statute, which we just don't have in this case.
Your position is that these statutes are similar, correct?
Yes.
And the difference of 0.10 at the time in Delaware and 0.08 in Florida does not make them dissimilar.
Yes, that is our position.
All right. What if it was 0.05? Would they be dissimilar?
I I don't think so. If I can point out, my friend across the aisle agrees, essentially in the opening brief, that the statutes are similar for purposes of this exercise, so we didn't delve into that. And I think if the number begins to change at some point, probably it would become a material difference. But I don't think so, because that's similar is going to similar as the qualifier suggests that there will be some type of differences. But both statutes contemplate that if you're driving while you're impaired, then you are driving under the influence. So a 0.5, 0.1, probably not enough, because even in Delaware, if you're driving it under 0.5, you could be found guilty based on a DUI based on that and other factors. So no, I guess at some point, you know, if you get to a zero tolerance versus a 0.1, probably that's a material difference in the statute. But I think the Superior Court is correct that at the time, 0.08 and 0.1 are not a material difference under the statute for purposes of rendering them dissimilar under 177B. Now,
let's suppose that the reading was 0.05 or point just barely, you just barely had alcohol in your system, but your driving was outrageous, and you entered a guilty plea. Generally speaking, if the statutes are similar, we say that a guilty plea really subsumes anything that you might have been able to raise in defense. If a court is supposed to compare statutes and statutes, and you plead guilty to a statutory offense, irrespective of the underlying evidence, why is the underlying evidence relevant at all?
Well, I think under the way the driving under the influence statute is worded, it's not relevant. And that, in a sense, is your notice as a defendant comes from the fact of the conviction. He's under notice of the fact of a conviction, got behind the wheel again, caused a very serious accident. So in that sense, the fact of the conviction is what is making him eligible for the enhanced penalty, not a breakdown of the underlying conduct in Florida.
Well, are there other states that have this similar statute phraseology in their habitual offender statutes? And if so, have those statutes been construed? That is, has this issue come up before in other states?
Yes. I'm not really prepared to give a multi-state analysis here at the moment. It has certainly come up. If the court wanted a few words on that, I'd be, you know, willing to do so.
Name one state that you know that it came up in. Any one state.
North Carolina in Rogers, which is one of the cases we cite to.
And did you shepherdize Rogers?
Yes, and I read a bit on this, but again, I'm not really ducking the question in the sense of this is the wording of the Delaware statute, and both parties agree in the briefing that the statutes were similar. So again, it's something we didn't.
But Justice Jacobs' question is, if other states have similar statutes, similar wordings, do you know of any other state courts that have said the underlying evidence is irrelevant or the underlying evidence is dispositive?
No, I don't. And where I was trying to get to with the second part of my argument is even under Morales and Fletcher are different. Were two cases where there was facially ambiguous evidence presented in those cases, and that's what concerned the court. In Morales, the evidence presented under 4214 showed a guilty plea, but then a withdrawn guilty plea, but did not articulate what the defendant pled guilty to in that case.
But what did the state introduce in this case?
As evidence of the fact of the prior conviction on the defendant's Delaware driver's record.
So, in other words, you got a piece of paper from the Department of Motor Vehicle,
yes,
who did a search, and they certified this is what our search showed.
Yes.
And how difficult would it be to get the record of the conviction from Florida? I mean, clearly it's not like getting it from the Delaware Department of Motor Vehicle, but in other instances, we see the state presenting evidence of convictions by getting them from the other state.
And that's under the habitual offender statute. And again, the wording of the statute sort of compels that approach by the state. But once again, the state would get, a certified copy of the docket, essentially not including a whole lot more information, which is the fact of the conviction, probably the indictment, which would give some indicator of what was pled to.
So what happens, if your name's John Smith,
mm-hmm.
And you say, well, that's not me, and the state says, well, I've got this Department of Motor Vehicle printout, says John Smith, and here you are, and this is your second offense.
As a Tom Brown, I'm acutely sensitive to that particular point. I've come across it a number of times. The defendant can always rebut the evidence presented against him, and this court says so as much in some of the cases that follow up in Morales. I'm duty-bound to say that is not this case, because the defendant doesn't argue the fact of the conviction in Florida. But if you look at some of the following cases, Hall, Trawick, I wouldn't know how to pronounce it, T-R-W-I-C-K, specifically contemplates that a defendant is going to be able to seek to rebut any evidence presented in the context of the habitual offender statute. But, I think that addresses the court's concern there. But even in the follow-up to Morales and Fletcher, given a record, an unambiguous record of a conviction, Morales and Fletcher don't even guide in the context of 4214, because in some of the ensuing cases, it was simply a fact of a commitment order which provided the quantum of proof necessary for the qualifying offense under the habitual offender statute. And again, I'm not a fan of comparing the two statutes, because I think 4177B is very clear that once the defendant is on notice of the fact of a conviction, that satisfies all the notice requirements. Take a quick minute. I'd like to correct two things in the brief. I believe in our facts we try to give the court a package, tell the story, whatever. I think I recall I'm a 27-year-old truck driver, and I noted in the record today that it says he's been a truck driver for 27 years. So if the court writes something, I don't want the court to pick up on what I wrote. And the other thing I got a little distracted by is we've all been referring to 4177BE2, and that's in the 1995 supplement. I mean, I picked up and ran with it. I offer no excuses, but I think the statute was renumbered in 1997, so we should all be saying BE1A. Again, it's just for a sense of accuracy. The substantive wording of the statute is not different. It just reworded the section and added the 5-year time limits.
Did Judge Silverman cite the statutes correctly?
He cited, well, not going to put me on record as saying that, are you, sir?
What happens if you write a letter to the court just noting these two corrections?
Sure. And again, I hate to see it fried in my citation. Nothing. If the court has no further questions, I would ask you to affirm Judge Silverman's opinion. I thought it was thoughtful and covered fairly well.
There's really nothing more to add than what I had already said. I don't believe the state has presented anything different than what we argued about in our briefing.
And getting ready for today's argument, I'm sure you shepherdized all your leading cases. Do you know of any states that have dealt with this problem we're struggling with, about notwithstanding the similarity in the text of the statute,
that the underlying evidence is really relevant or it's not relevant?
I believe, Your Honor, there is a case in Minnesota that would support the state's, that I believe supports the state's position. I found the case but did not actually have a, I couldn't get a copy of it. I believe I have the site, but...
Well, your candor is commendable.
Thank you.
And I'd like you to send that site to the court, copy to the state, and the court would like you both, we'll say within 10 days, to see if you can find any cases from any other states where the statutes have been similar and the underlying evidence was either relevant or it wasn't relevant. You can just do that simultaneously in 10 days.
Thank you. Nothing else then.
Thank you. And the court will take this matter under advisement, and I'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.